One of the most promising disruptions of our time is making over 80% of the health news today. Artificial intelligence sounds and acts like one of the biggest leaps in computer sciences, and in healthcare it's probably the most significant breakthrough since the discovery of antibiotics. It is already affecting medical practices, applied biomedical research, diagnostics, and even patient-provider relationships. It will certainly keep affecting other areas in the delivery of healthcare and prevention as we go. This is just the beginning, we just don't know. Now, while everyone, literally everyone, is talking about the specific AI interventions, specific applications, and claiming the benefits around them, today we wanted to have a deeper and a more meaningful conversation on how machine learning technologies and AI agents are developed and how they are used in healthcare. How can AI become a force of good and reduce the equity divide in healthcare? How can we harness its power to foster inclusiveness for a wider societal benefit? How can we avoid having AI become yet another technology that will become a barrier to widen the access to prevention and to better healthcare services? And beyond regulations, what are the ethical boundaries to be considered?
Welcome to Health Tech Central, the podcast that connects you with the wisdom of trailblazers at the intersection of health, care, and technology. 42-ish minutes of entertaining inspiration, actionable insights, and answers to just about everything. Hitchhiking most definitely allowed. With your host, Mehdi Khaled.
He envisions a future where technology reduces inequalities rather than exacerbating them. His approach combines technical expertise with a strong ethical framework aimed at fostering collaboration and community ownership of health data. But welcome to the show, my friend, and good to see you after so many years.
Yeah, Mehdi, thank you for having me. Actually, we know each other since a few decades.
That's true.
So that's how old we are. But great to be back in touch with you. So after our world journey.
Thank you. Look, some keywords here. When I started introducing you, some keywords resonate with me. Collective data ownership, inclusive healthcare, and let's say health innovation equity. These are really big topics. And you're on a crusade, man. You started in 1989 with your thesis on AI. I mean, I see a lot of people on LinkedIn overnight becoming AI experts. It's funny because that's really the reality of what we observe here. And so by all standards and means, I mean, you are an AI authority. So what a journey, man. Tell me more.
Well, yes, even in that paper in 89, I wrote that AI will help us to reduce inequalities in health and support African doctors. I have no clue where I got that from back then, but my uncle worked in a bank and was working on expert systems, and I was a gamer, and I loved gaming against computers. So that's how these things merged together. Ever since then, I've been always fascinated. And when I moved to IBM in 2010, after having been part of the creation of the data layer that AI needs, meaning implementing electronic medical records and patient information systems, working for SAP. I started to work with IBM Research with machine learning, and then I was totally fascinated to see what we could do. And then there was a whole journey, but I think we will discuss this today. But it is absolutely fascinating, but it's also, on the other side, fascinating to see how slow adoption is moving. I think we can do way more, and we need to learn from the mistakes, but for some reason, we don't seem to learn well.
You know what? We don't learn well from the mistakes, because I believe as much as medicine has learned a lot from mistakes, digital health doesn't want to talk about mistakes somehow. It's somehow, the black box in digital health almost doesn't exist. Nobody seems to be learning from them. But we'll get to that later on. You know, the format of the show. What's your funniest moment in your career? What was one of the funniest, strangest moments that you've been through? Well,
The most awkward moment, I was working for IBM, heading Central Eastern Europe, and I had to do a lot of talks, and I was invited in Istanbul for a conference to open the conference. And it was quite early in the morning, in the evening, I was with some friends drinking a lot of rakı. Said my night was pretty short. So I thought I was going to wake up by drinking a few Turkish coffees before going on stage. I went to stage, stood on the desk, and what they didn't tell me is that while I'm standing there, there was first a kids show that went over 60 minutes. And I don't know if anybody's familiar with Turkish coffee, but if you're not used to drink Turkish coffee, it urged you to go on the toilet. So I was standing behind the desk and I had cramps in my legs and I was feeling so uncomfortable, living in fear that a mistake will happen. It actually didn't happen, but I never touched on Turkish coffee ever again.
Well, not before you go on stage anyway, so...
No. It's absolutely not the right thing to drink before you go on stage.
So look, let's get the elephant in the room. You're a big proponent of open source, and I hear your voice, and I think that's the right path to follow, and I believe in the value of doing that. Now, how do you respond to critics who really argue that, you know, open source medical AI could compromise patient privacy, data security, etc., etc.? What's your take on that?
I always try to break it down on realistic cases. Open source medical AI is not as straightforward as open source software. You cannot publish the open data sets of our people with all these sensitive data. You cannot create open data set in the molecular space and genetic because you cannot anonymize these data sets. So there are constraints. But there are different ways of learning. So we have federated learning that allow us to pre-train and do fine-tuning in a federated approach where the data stays at the data holder. So most of these issues are solvable and can be solved. And then also we need to look at what kind of data are we talking about. So if that would be really an issue as a barrier, privacy, then why haven't we seen a terabyte or terabytes of open data in histopathology? Histopathology data is not re-identifiable. There is no way you can re-identify a human from looking at a histopathological slide. So if privacy is the issue for not opening data, why haven't we seen huge amounts of histopathological data? And the reason is that privacy is important, but privacy is also a nice alibi in order to create scarcity around the data. And if you create scarcity around the data, you create value, economic value. And there are many, many data holders that are selling their data access. And this is a very short-sighted view on creating that or leveraging that value. And I think the concerns completely ignore that in the last few years we have seen quite a lot of privacy or data breached or breaches. Like 2023, Microsoft AI research team even exposed 38 terabytes of private data, when we know the Google Project Nightingale, where 50 million patient records were used by Google researchers, who said that the models being trained on these records cannot replicate the data or leak the data. In the first half of this year, there were 341 health data breaches reported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Science. And last year, there were 540 healthcare organizations that reported data breaches. So 90% of our healthcare organizations have faced at least one security breach in the recent years based on data breaches. So the whole discussion about privacy and is for me a smokescreen for people who want to monetize the AI and gain short-term benefits for themselves out of that data.
Yeah, I think you mean it's just a distraction, really, and it's not a real problem.
It can be solved technologically by the implementation. Yeah. It is not the distraction. It's an alibi to not act on it. And It is a nice distraction because it means that you created a $1 billion business, a data economy around sharing these data sets.
Absolutely. You remember Mario Draghi's report on the 9th of September, yes. I guess this year, 9th of September, to the EU Commission that says, among other messages, it was a great report around like 70% of foundational AI models have been developed in the US since 2017. That indicates to me that clearly Europe is lagging behind in this field. So, and you know,
25% of it was in China. 25% is in China, only 5% in Europe.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. 5% in Europe. Yeah, well, but big US companies, well, China is coming big time, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's just a matter of time. The volume of scale of data they have in China is just beyond any imagination. But big US tech companies basically are investing heavily in health AI. I mean, I've just recently been looking at the patent filing applications. It's staggering, like 2,000 filings in 2022. I don't have the 23 data. Now, what are the risks of allowing a few powerful corporations, yet again, we seem to never learn, right? To control the future of medical knowledge, because that's what AI is. It's medical knowledge and decision-making.
Yeah, it is even more because we have entered the age of general purpose AI. So we have AI models that not only can be a good doctor, but be a good life consultant or legal counselor, because these models can do quite a lot. And that means that these models have become a repository of culture and knowledge. So there are many even more aspects around this, because if you have a monopolized system, you're going to homogenize a culture, which has huge impact, because I've recently used the word imperialistic AI, an AI that really changes and homogenizes the mindset of people, just like we have seen in the PsyOps operations with, I live in Berlin, there was a radio station that was broadcasting to eat Germany to change the mindset. Like, these tools are being used and politicized. So it goes beyond healthcare. But on your question going to healthcare, I think healthcare is unique because unlike any other sectors, people prioritize spending to preserve their life and health almost over any other concern. And this means people will spend their last time in order to kind of survive and live in that sense. And that means you can, in a non-controlled environment, you would be able, if you own all that knowledge, you could capitalize on that situation that people are dependent on that knowledge. And what we have seen in healthcare is the so-called financial assetization of life-saving knowledge that has increasingly has become a problem. So like in the pharmaceuticals, essentially, knowledge such as drug formulations or medical data or even now AI-driven diagnostics are often treated as proprietary assets. And that means they become a financial asset. Now, the difference between assets and a commodity is that the price of assets increases when the demand goes up. And there is a very good example that I always use is the price of insulin in the US. Insulin was invented or discovered 100 years ago by Sir Benting, a Canadian physician, who sold his patent for $1, and then it became into ownership of Eli Lilly. Well, Eli Lilly was able to manage and control that patent for over 100 years by having always done incremental innovations. They also gave Novo Nordisk and Sanofi access to their patents. But what happened in the last two decades is that the price of insulin increased by 1,200%, which led into 50,000 people in the US dying from diabetes because they didn't have access to insulin. Now, I use this as an example because everybody thought like, well, insulin is there and are we over time going to be able to create it very cheap? It will become a commodity. Well, it didn't because it was an asset. The financial markets will define the price. Any financial markets then see that people are dependent from that in order to live. There was this sort of perversity that you can increase the price no matter what and start to shift the price so high that people start to fall out and you create even inequality in the richest country of the world. Now, if we then translate this to medical AI, we are not there yet at all. But imagine we would end up in a world where we have a sort of a monopoly or an oligopoly or an AI singleton, where a single company owns all the knowledge, medical knowledge in the world. That will be not used for giving everybody shared access if that asset is being handled in the same way as the financial assets we have seen in the pharma biotech industry. And I believe that this is absolutely unnecessary to do that. There is way more to gain by creating that as an open source asset or turning that into in a community asset or into a common good. I think there are many, many different ways of creating value, economical value, instead of having that centralized. So there are two approaches that we can have. Or we're going to allow the markets to consolidate and we have a centralized oligopoly, or we're going to have a market that is competitive, that drives the prices down, and where the assets are being shared. And these are the two scenarios that we will have. There will be no other scenario. And I think everybody who has a kind of normal sense of understanding, the affairs, of course, that open scenario, but 99% of the people that I meet are working towards the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hairy problem there, really, because you see the economic forces that are there that just massive. I mean, in terms of, we started talking about the AI models and foundational models have been developed elsewhere. You talked about the diagnostics, say an MRI enabled or empowered machine with AI to do a better, you know, diagnosis of a breast cancer, mammographies, etc. Now, we know that those patents exist. Those modalities owners have the patents on the AI model. The problem of that is those models have been developed and trained on breast densities in the US, of women in the US. Now, you go to another country, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, or for the sake of it, Middle East, who is buying a ton of AI applications from the US right now. Those models do not work. Not with the accuracy, with the specificity, and the specificity and accuracy of the model in the US. Why? Because the breast densities of these women living in these geographies are different.
Yes.
And so, you lose on specificity and accuracy. And so it's very important to retrain the models. And I agree with you. If we democratize the data and we have access, it allows for a more diversified data set and a nuanced approach and a nuanced output as well. So I fully agree with you.
I was recently at the Frontiers Health Conference here in Berlin, and I had a very interesting fireside chat with the inventor, co-inventor of the transformer models, who was 15 years at Google. And he's also working on generative AI now in the biotech space. And during that conference, I felt this continuous tone of 15 years of frustration. I know most of the people since 15 years, because digital health is not as advancing as fast as they thought it would be. I saw private equity guys, VCs, and the general tone was a disappointment about the expectations of digital health. But about that stage, I asked the audience to do a thought exercise and say, like, imagine the digital health tools or the AI solutions are the books that we read and where we read our knowledge from. And that the companies who create these books are the startups and the companies, and in the book world, that would be the publishers. Now, imagine as a thought exercise that Gutenberg would have patented the alphabet and then sold each letter to different companies, and you would then try to write a book. And for each letter, you need a license and you need to pay for someone to write words. And probably Luther would never have written his alternative Bible. Probably he would only have seen 20 publishers and perhaps 100 books or whatever. We would not have seen that whole revolution that started after Gutenberg democratized access to books. Now, for some reason in healthcare, we then grasp that we need to liberate that data. We need to stop filtering that data. Interoperability has nothing to do with it. This is about an economical grab on that data, trying to create assets. And that doesn't work. That's why 15 years of stagnation, because we are not sharing data. We are not creating a common layer that we can build on and then perhaps shift economical value creation to what I call the next level of economical value creation, which is the experience economy. I think everybody complains about the experience in healthcare. True, I agree. But it's because we have no competition. We are stuck in a world where we are creating artificial scarcity on knowledge, and that's where the competition is. And nobody cares about experience. All those who still remember the European telcos, national telcos, before there was an open market, you had one single telco, try to dial in the call center, they didn't care about experience. Experience was not necessary or was not important, customer experience, because they had a monopoly. And in healthcare, everybody has a sort of monopoly on knowledge, or I have the monopoly of treating, I have the monopoly of diagnosing. And that's absolutely ridiculous when you think that everything is getting digitized and becomes some sort of software code. I think we need to shift it into a new future that is way more sustainable. And companies can grow. I don't have anything against profit. I don't have anything against economical growth. But grow on experience and competing on brand experience, just like we have seen in consumer markets.
Yeah, that's interesting. So now, you talked about Gutenberg and the alphabet, that switched to Chinese right away because it's free. Alphabet is much richer there. So.
No, but absolutely,
it's a very good analogy with the alphabet and selling every letter. And by the time you finish your book, there is another set of alphabet that you have to buy again.
Yeah, and we have another example. The Human Genome Project, that was the biggest open source project in the 90s. There were 28 institutes all sequencing the first human genome. And there was at the same time a biotech investor called Craig Venter with Solaris who was trying to patent the human genome. It was exactly the same story.
Yes.
And then there was John Stilston, who was the ethicist of the project, who later got a Nobel Prize for that, for his work and his life dedication on ethics and open access. And it was Bill Clinton and Tony Blair. These are, for me, really the most social persons in the world who forbid that we could patent the human genome.
Yes.
And now there are papers, 25 years later, that have proven that by opening up, it's like similar to the Gutenberg movement, that it has created $1 trillion in value creation, over $1 trillion in the system. Now, imagine Craig Venter would have patented the alpha, the human genome. I don't think we would have seen $1 trillion in value creation. I don't think we would have seen the price of sequencing as one of the only technologies in healthcare that kind of followed Moore's law and became more performant and cheaper. All the other ones go actually in the opposite way. And I think the reason for that is that we all have that common ground, that shared asset that was free for use, free for innovation. And it just accelerated innovation and it increased the economy. And that's a very recent example instead of the Gutenberg example. And all the proof is there.
Yeah, basically, let's compete on a fair ground to add value and not compete on fake grounds to just be a middleman of something that everybody should own at the same time. Maybe CRISPR would have never existed if the DNA or the human genome was not really set free and made open for everybody to access, and other technologies, by the way, too. So, which brings us to the next question, actually, because some argue that open source medical AI could slow innovation by removing financial incentives,
right?
So, how and most of all, right, where do you envision the first system that balances openness with the continued progress and development? So, and this is related, really, to me at least, it's tightly related to this question. Is there a flaw in the current investment framework and incentives? Because honestly, anyone, any VC in healthcare or anyone investing in health tech in general or biotech is in there for the profit, is in there for the ROI, for the money. How much money are we making out of this? Which is fine. But then initially, isn't it about impact? Should we review the incentives and make sure that there is an impact first before? I mean, doing well by doing good and not the other way around. That's what I mean. I mean, is there a flaw in the model? And how do you see that?
I don't think you have to oppose those, but there was the flaw in that statement. That's why I had to smile. That open source medical AI would slow down innovation. I have to laugh with this because that is, sorry for my words, that's absolutely bullshit. That is nothing. There's no sense of reality. Like, everybody who was part of the open source large language model movement, which started 2 years ago, like, we had OpenAI suddenly publishing GPT-4 in a very close way. It upset so many people that they took the open source published papers of the attention is all you need paper and then used all that knowledge to then and then actually scrape the internet and then whatever was else closed it again. It really pissed off quite a lot of people. And that is good because that's game theory. And in game theory, the picture of an enemy, a joint enemy, unites people to fight against that enemy. So that was the reason why we suddenly saw a huge movement on people building open source alternatives. And when Meta joined that movement and published Llama, the first Llama model, which some people argue that it's not really open source because they don't give access to which data they are using, which is true, but I think open source is an AI gradient, has much more grades as with software. But there was a paper that told them that Google had no moat against the open source movement because the open source movement was written there is way faster in innovating. It does things way cheaper. That's what actually happened. Like when Llama came out, there were suddenly offsprings that I call them. That was Vicuna and there were other models. And within 2 months' time, there was a version from Llama that you can run on your desktop computer. Nobody would even imagine that you could run a large language model on your desktop. I don't think it's even an interest for big tech to run a model on your desktop because you suddenly don't need cloud infrastructure anymore to use these things. And out of that, all innovative, the innovation accelerated. There's cross-pollination. Now there are statistics that show standardly on Hugging Face, which is like the GitHub for the open source AI community. If somebody publishes a pre-trained LLM on Hugging Face, it takes 6 minutes until somebody uploads a fine-tuned model on that model that was uploaded. 6 minutes. Now, tell me in which corporate organization you can accelerate that fast. I've worked in corporate 20 years of my life. These open R&D, open science movements are way faster. They're way cheaper. And the motivation is very different because the motivation of the contributor is to become more visible. It's reputation-based, similar to in science publishing. And the incentives are very different. You don't need money for doing that and to collaborate. Yes, you do need support, but it's a very different way of doing that. So telling that open source would slow down innovation because we're removing the financial incentives. It is nonsense. Like, there is no proof for that. We even have seen that during COVID. In COVID, we had an acceleration problem because we knew we needed probably 3, 5, 4, 5 years to get a vaccine in the market. It didn't take that long. You know why? Because we opened up the data. We opened, we started sharing, we started doing that, what the open source community does. And it led to the fastest ever development of a vaccine. Afterwards, they closed the door again and we had that rubber band effect. We went back into the old state. But we learned there are many papers that prove that suddenly by publishing all the papers in an open access license, by sharing the data, that this was the contributor for that acceleration. So I don't understand why people still claim that open source would remove the financial incentives. That it probably removes the financial incentives for the ones that want to have short-term gains on the data that is not theirs, but that they hold on their records. Yes, that will perhaps disappear. But that's a good thing. If we eliminate these gatekeepers, then we will accelerate innovation. And healthcare is more like a Game of Thrones, and these thrones are kept by gatekeepers, and everybody knows that in such a game, there is hardly a democracy. And in this feudal system, we kind of lived in a European Middle Ages in that feudal system. that was the time where we had the slowest devolution of knowledge. These things don't work. We had the Enlightenment moving, we had the open science movement, we had so many proof in history that accelerating only works when we break down these barriers. So that's an absolute lie. So the collaboration works faster. If there was democratized access, the increased transparency leads to other people to peer review, validate. There was a recent case in the community of somebody who claimed to have suddenly a very powerful open source model, and he lied. But it took only 6 days for the community to find out he lied. It's the public scrutiny of the community that works really, really well. I think, again, coming to my point, we need to stop being stuck in a system where we create artificial scarcity and thinking that we need incentives because we need to pay the licenses for the Gutenberg alphabet. We need to do the opposite. We need to liberate these assets in order to accelerate innovation and make it less costly and democratize it so we can have way more contributors and at the end save way more lives.
Now, I'm going to trigger you with another question. That one got you really fired up. The next question is, I like this discussion. I'm liking it. And it's really genuine. And I can feel the passion behind it. And that's great. Now, you know as much as I do, but we've been in the corporate world for forever, you and I. Some people, many people in the corporate world and also politicians, get their paychecks, are paid bonuses, to not understand what you're talking about. Everything you said now, some people are paid to not understand what you're talking about, and you know what I'm talking about. And so that's the biggest challenge to me. How do you get the message across to these people? I mean, this is a massive, these are decision makers. These are companies that will help shape the future of everything AI in healthcare, etc. And so how do you get around that? Not shortcut, but what's the way? Uh-huh. What's the path? What's the workaround?
But there's no workaround.
I've been facing this myself for the longest time. So yeah, the higher you go, the more people do not understand what you're talking about and make a purpose of it.
The good thing is that when you keep on being focused on one topic, that 5 years later you can go back and say, like, look, you know what we discussed? They didn't understand me, but here's the proof. And I had that with, I met 25 members of the German parliament 5 years ago. And I said, we need to create policies to accelerate open source AI in Europe because that would make Europe more competitive. Now, we talked about the Draghi report. It's all about competitiveness. And they looked at me, it's like, never, they didn't understand it. And so I went back to a few of those people because something happened in Germany, which is a very good use case that is really hurting some people in their proudness in that sense. There were two promising AI company startups, one in Germany and there's one in France. The one in Germany is called Aleph Alpha. The other one is called Mistral AI. And they both were targeting to build their own LLMs and creating what it's called digital sovereignty. And I know Joanna's the CEO and the founder of Aleph Alpha. And 3 years ago, I told him, you should push for open source. You're going to accelerate. And you do that until you are on par and competitive with OpenAI. Then you can always still consider of closing a few models to create a business model. But at the beginning, why should you close it? And it's like, no, I cannot. We need to create patterns and whatever. Then there is Mistral AI, which Aleph Alpha was already 4 years on the market when Mistral AI came. Mistral AI came. They both got at that time the same level of funding, around 550 million in funding. And it was like everybody wanted to create their own platforms. Mistral AI went completely for the opposite. They went for open source. And within a short time, they published their models, and these models are being downloaded 1 million times a month. Wow. 1 million times a month. If only from that 1 million time, 1% does something innovative and republishes that, you will accelerate your R&D. And that's actually what happened. Within 11 months, Mistral AI was able to compete with GPT-4, and they closed on the model called Mistral Large. And within 1 year, they had 65 million in revenues. And if you compare it to Aleph Alpha, after 5 years, they had less than 1 million euros in revenue. their models are not even reaching on the top 100, and completely failed. And recently they announced they're not going to build LLMs. They're going to do system integration of other LLMs that other people develop. The valuation of Mistral AI is now at 7 billion. The valuation of Aleph Alpha is probably less than the 500 million investment. Now, that's a lesson learned. I can comment all the numbers. There is only one proof here that in this new world, it's not about ownership anymore. This is about speed, velocity, and creating community and platform and access to that. That's a whole new world, a whole new mindset that people need. So coming back to your question, I noticed that we need to really work on education. That's why I'm being very intensively being holding keynotes, educating on business schools and sharing that knowledge in order to break down these dogmas, because these are all false statements and false dogmas that are from last century. This has nothing to do with today's world. Even Y Combinator, the biggest accelerator in the US, now 35% of the startups are fully open sourced in their core. Because why? They come faster to market, they have higher growth, they will gain more trust. There is only advantages of doing so. And I feel that in Europe, we are stuck with hierarchies, and there are people in lead that don't understand anything anymore of what's happening. And they come with these old narratives, old dogmas, thinking that we need to close up things and own assets before you even have any percent of market share. So I think we need to work a lot on awareness, advocacy, education, and spread knowledge in order to change the mindset of people. It's really hard. It is. I've been suffering in the last 5 years. It's not an easy trajectory being the Robin Hood or being the lone crusader in a world full of Game of Thrones. It's like really coming with the flag of democracy in that Game of Thrones, and everybody who watched these series on Netflix knows if you would have done that, you would have not have a long life. And I think it's worth fighting for. I have children. I don't want them to wake up in a world where there's a AI singleton. I'm a European. I think we have amazing talent, but we need different incentives. We need to collaborate. We need to use all these talents, pull them together. There are examples for that. There was a project called Big Science, which was building one of the first open source LLMs. The second one with 188 billion parameters, and they published a paper, and the first four pages of that paper are 1,000 authors. So these were 1,000 authors, similar like with the Human Genome Project, all collaborating on shared principles, shared values, and a shared vision. And I think one of the things we need to change is the incentives for researchers, because if you are a researcher, you don't want to have 1,000 others on your paper, because you're not going to have that impact factor that you need in order to get funding for your research.
Don't get me started on the impact factor. We know that's the definition is so weird. Well, don't get me started on that. And don't get me started on the European Union that went to choose you-know-who instead of taking a European product, Mistral AI.
Yeah, Anthropic. The Anthropic. I posted that to me.
Okay. Don't get me started. That's subject for another discussion. Last question, but... And then we'll move to to your recommendation and lessons learned. You've spoken a lot about AI potentially freeing up physicians' time for administrative work, etc. You know, could the over-reliance on AI in healthcare lead to a loss of human touch or intuition in medicine? I mean, I'm a big proponent, not trying to influence you, but being a physician, I can take a little stab at that, but the answer. But then I can, you know, my view is, AI should be used with a grain of salt, being aware and, you know, keeping the critical thinking for doctor. And I know for sure that not many doctors are critical thinkers. I can tell you that. And so the question is really, beyond regulations, how can health professionals in general ethically harness the power of AI in their daily jobs?
I think that's a very good question because there's a lot of fear connected to that question within the physician community. And I think that the fear has different dimensions. One fear is that physicians can become the pharmacists of the 19th century, where all their knowledge is becoming industrialized and owned by a few companies. and physicians become salesmen of AI tools coming from big tech, similar like pharmacists became salesmen of big pharma. That is one dimension of fear, because you lose control and ownership of medical knowledge. The other one is that you would be replaced by autonomous systems where the physician is being replaced. And I think that's absolutely nonsense. Everybody who had cancer in their family, and you know, when you have these more severe diseases, you want to have somebody who touches your shoulder. You want to be taken care of the most knowledgeable person around you. And if that person is augmented by AI, I think that's perfectly fine. And if he perhaps has more time, because he's using an AI scribe that automates the documentation, where according to recent papers, there was a study from Kaiser Permanente that used a startup called Nabla from France, and they saw that it's not perfect, the transcription, that these things make mistakes. 80% of the patients reported that the physicians that used Nabla were way more interactive, looking way more in their eyes because they were not using the keyboard, and had way more time to become what you said, like become again a physician that touches the patients, that listens to the patient and has empathy and is a caregiver in that sense. Now, regarding the second part of your question on intuition, I think intuition is better recognition in some sense, which is what AI is also doing, like a lot of the AI systems. Are what Daniel Kahneman calls system one and system two thinking, like one is analytical and one is just pattern recognition and automated. I think a lot of the physicians are working on intuition and see patterns. Now, AI can do that as well. I think if we replace these intuitive parts by AI and leave the analytical part, because we don't have AI that can reason yet, all these reports that AI can reason are, out of my perspective, not real, and that physicians are using their time for the really severe cases where they need to be analytical in that sense. I think we can improve the profession of physicians tremendously. Because if you look at the current situation, physicians spend less than 50% of their time on patients. They're doing more administrative work. There is high burnouts. I think 70% of the medical records even have inaccuracies, incomplete information, all these things, because a physician needs to see every X minutes a new patient. I think AI can really help to automate that part. And I think AI can double the productivity, if you can call it that, the time to patients. So we have that, what you said, more human touch, more empathy, and the physician can be that what he was back then, a caregiver that is the trusted person for that patient, that guides that patient to his disease journey.
Last few words, but in terms of what are your recommendations and lessons learned, what is it that you recommend people to not do? You know, what are the mistakes that people can learn from your journey, or, you know, key takeaways, basically one or two or three takeaways that you can think of?
Well, if you don't have too much financial freedom, don't do what I did, starting a nonprofit. And that's really not a financially wise discussion, but I was on a learning journey. I'm building something new based on open source. That means that everyone who starts a new startup, they should really consider in building open source and then selecting what is that core value driver that I will monetize on. Like if you look at Red Hat, which was a company that took Linux, which was open source, and then they create a sort of shell around Linux, which created a premium service layer, became a company that IBM bought for $38 billion. You can gain a lot of value by using open source elements and building these things differently. I recently on my blog, I published a summary of all the histopathology, digital pathology companies that are now started to do exactly what I wanted them to do 5 years ago, but they are starting to publish their foundation models as open source models. So you see that now finally that companies starting to understand that by open sourcing their AI models and not patenting them, they will innovate faster, they will lower their R&D cost and gain faster market access at the end. And that's what it's about. If you build a product, think about what you want to do. Do you want to create assets? Because your investors from day one want you to build assets then I think your investor has a failure mindset. Because if he went from day one to have these assets, then he's already thinking when you go bankrupt that he wants to protect as much assets as possible. Because in case of a bankruptcy, he can still sell the assets. If you had that sort of an investor, leave that investor immediately because he doesn't really understand what your journey will be. So I think it's all about building your vision, creating what your core value driver will be, and perhaps it's something new. Perhaps by open sourcing things, you will create a new layer of interaction and create new data that hasn't been seen before. And it's totally fine to make that proprietary data and start making your gains on that data because it's unique. So in that case, you will be able to find your niche to create value and accelerate because everything else will be open source except of that niche. Think about open source when you build something. And then for governments, please support open source initiatives. There was in the coalition agreement in Germany a sentence, public money, public code. Unfortunately, the government didn't live by that. But I think if we as citizens and society spend money with our insurance contributions and our tax dollars or euros in order to create that data, I think in public research, the results should be as well lead to open source developments and not to exclusive assets. We have seen the mistake we have made with scientific publishing. Elsevier, Springer, all these companies are more profitable than Google and other big tech companies based on just the fact that they took copyrights on things that were actually public assets, turned them into financial assets, and have created a huge inequality in the science community. I was last in Guatemala. I talked to brilliant researchers. I said, we cannot pay for these publishing fees in Guatemala. We cannot even participate in the global research community. All these mistakes, everybody knows. We should not repeat that. So policymakers, if you are listening, don't repeat these mistakes. If you have children and if you care about the future of healthcare and about equality and access of care.
The future of healthcare is open source. The future of healthcare data is open source. That accelerates everything, delivers more value, more impact, collective leadership, collective data ownership. Thank you, Bart, for this amazing talk. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for being with me. See you soon.
Thank you, Mehdi, for having me. I hope I provoked enough for people to open their mindset and think differently.
Cheers. Thank you very much. See you soon.
Cheers.
This has been Health Tech Central. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast channel and give us a rating or review. Finally, you can check out our news on healthtechcentral.io and inspire us with your feedback. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next exciting episode of Health Tech Central.